the inductor was inside inside the power supply. Was it bolted down at the time when the voltage was dropping? And you, did you ever try loosening the screws just to lift it up off the chassis to see if the performance would change? I'm just wondering those kinds of things. And sometimes you can even get an AC leakage, and it will cause very, very strange things to happen. And even still, I could still even believe it, even with the peak voltage on the transformer. But leakage can do some very, very strange things. I've seen some really, really odd things take place in the output. But and also there again, it could be intermittent. But the fact that also that he ran higher current through the inductor, and the resistance still didn't drop too much, would still lead me to believe that there, it's not a burnout kind of a thing. But yeah, that's about all that I have on that one, Dick. Back over to you, KC2 QIQ.
Yeah, this was still a fairly tough one. Without a doubt, the case was grounded to the chassis of the power supply. The winding was running at something like 800 volts above ground. And Joe has done that and measured the current into the winding when it's 800 volts above ground. I'm relatively sure, I'm going to pass it over to Joe in a minute here, I'm relatively sure he did not do the unusual experiment of loosening all the screws of the case of the choke, isolating it with, you know, pieces of cardboard so that it's floating above ground. I'm pretty sure he did not do that. That's an unusual thing to do. And by the way, for the leakage current to ground at 800 volts on the winding to the core of the grounded choke, for that to affect you AC-wise without DC-wise, in other words, 800 volts, it's a fraction of a microamp of current that flows. And even there, the metering could have been giving us a false indication. It may not really be current leakage in the transformer itself, in the choke itself. But for it to have AC leakage without DC leakage, which means that internally it would have to develop a lot of microfarads. Not impossible, but hard to do. Yeah, I know that water is going to dielectric constant of 81, and if there's a whole lot of water in there, you can develop some capacitance. But I can't believe that the water in there is perfectly distilled and so low in its ion content that is only a fraction of a microamp of current flowing when the core is 800 volts, when the winding is 800 volts above ground. So you've got a hypothesis. It's a tough one to confirm, as you can see. Let Joe. We put a whole lot of words in his mouth here with a whole lot of suggestions, and let's see if I haven't misquoted him and the testing that's done so far. So B2RYY for any further comments on the big power supply mystery. K2RYW in the TechNet.
2EO, Dick.
Rich recognized. We'll come back to you. Go ahead, Joe.
Okay, what do you want to know first?
I guess the first thing I want to know is, in the comments we've made so far, in what we've described, and what we think you did we misquote you? Did we put words in your mouth? In other words, I'm reasonably sure you did not isolate the core with pieces of cardboard, you know, loosen the screws so that the transformer is operating above ground on the chassis. That's an unusual thing to do. Glenn was suggesting that. I'm sure that hasn't been done yet. The fact that you replaced a nearly identical choke from a so-called good power supply to the so-called bad power supply, and the choke replacement essentially fixed the problem, and that when you make reasonable laboratory measurements on the so-called bad choke, we haven't yet discovered anything wrong, except that under very low DC loading of current flowing through it, it shows 14 Henrys instead of 5 Henrys. That's good. Except for any possible resonance phenomenon, the only thing that stops people from putting a large choke in there is that it would take up too many square inches of chassis space. So I'm going to pass it back to you, Joe, for any comments on have we misquoted you. If not, then we're going to go over to Rich and see what he's got to say. To B2RYY with some delay, K2RYW in the net.
Okay, I did not test the choke in the power supply disconnected from the chassis. It's kind of weighty. It weighs about a pound and a half, maybe 2 pounds. It's fairly moderate in size. Almost resembles like a power transformer. And the leads are really not that long on this thing. And the way it's attached to the circuit boards that are mounted above it, if you were to pull the wires, you'd probably end up ripping off the circuit board. They're not meant to do that kind of thing. So I really didn't have that kind of option to do that. What is a mystery here, why does a choke that has a rating of 5 Henrys give me an apparent AC reactance across their 5,500 ohms instead of 1,883, as you said the choke should be with its rating of 5 Henry's. And it's telling me, if you work the formula backwards, that its apparent rating is now something over 14 Henry's. Why would I get a reading like that?
Yeah, I think I've got an explanation for that one, Joe. Glenn was giving us a hint about that before when he talked about the BH curve. And to an engineer who's into magnetics, BH has some meaning. To the vast majority of ham radio operators and to 80% of the engineers in this world, you talk about the BH rating of materials and they'll look at you with a deadpan face, you know, what the hell are you talking about? H is the ampere turns of the current you're putting through a winding of a transformer or a choke. So you count the number of turns, you count the amperes you're putting into it, and ampere turns represents the motive force that's capable of creating a magnetic field. And if the core of the coil that we're talking about, that's got the ampere turns flowing through it, was air, you can rather easily predict how much magnetic field that number of ampere turns would create for you. However, when you put real materials in there that are magnetic, like a certain kind of iron, if the amount of magnetic field you get is 50 times higher than you would if there was air in that core, then you, by definition, have a magnetic material that has multiplied your magnetic field by 50. We say that that particular magnetic material, with its mechanical configuration of the EI laminations, is acting like a mu of 50. Mu is the magnetic field magnification, because you put magnetic material there. You put steel laminations there. The magnetic field will flow through the steel 50 times better than it flows through air. And you get 50 times more magnetic field, in my example, in that so-called BH curve. Okay, when you really plot more and more ampere turns going into a particular magnetic material, let me drop, you expect to see horizontal axis is ampere turns, we call that H, vertical axis is magnetic field, we call it B, and we expect that to be a 45 degree line across the graph. Very similar to what would happen if I had a resistor and my horizontal line was voltage and my vertical line was current. I'd draw a straight line across there at a 45 degree angle, and the slope of that angle would be how many ohms is in my resistor. I'd be plotting Ohm's law, so to speak. Well, there's a magnetic field equivalent. However, with real magnetic materials, you start increasing the current flowing through the same number of windings. You're increasing the ampere turns, and you expect the magnetic field to increase. Eventually, that magnetic field line doesn't go up vertically anymore. It becomes a horizontal line. You've saturated that core. Every magnetic material, other than air, will saturate at some number of ampere turns. And so there's a whole bunch of ratings of your particular magnetic field as to how fast it saturates. When you put a DC current through a choke, you already are walking up one side of that BH curve, so to speak. You're getting close to that saturation point. The slope of that curve, just like the slope of the curve if you were plotting current and voltage on a resistor, the slope tells you how many ohms you've got. Well, in the case of magnetic material, where you're plotting B and H, the slope of the curve tells you Henry's, or mu, you could call it, but it really, in your case, it's telling you Henry's. When you put DC current through the coil, and it's starting to curve over on its curve, it's starting to flatten out, it's starting to saturate, you will get a lower slope, therefore you get less Henry's. The bottom line of all this is that every real choke, depending on its design, will come down to a lower number of Henry's, depending on how much DC current you put through the choke. Every choke will do that. That's part of the reason why the choke has a... Let me drop. There's two reasons why the choke has a current rating. Number one, the wire in there has got a certain gauge to it, and it can't take more than a certain amount of current without experiencing excess heating. Second of all, as you put more current through the choke, and you've got a fixed number of turns, you're starting to saturate the iron. So every real transformer will come down to a lower and lower number of Henry's as you put current through it. Now, if the designer of that power supply designed it for a 5 Henry choke, there is a slim possibility that he started off with a choke that is with no DC current, 14 Henrys, and that choke comes down to 5 Henrys under rated load, when it's at the rated load for that particular power supply. That in itself, that measurement you made, which looks alarming, it might be within the original designer's criteria for what he assigned for that choke. As you can tell, we amateurs are a little bit light on transformer and choke theory of operation. When I was first designing my own transistorized power supplies, way back in the dark ages of 1958-59, when I made my first transistorized transmitter, I couldn't walk into Edley Electronics, or I couldn't walk into Lafayette Electronics. Radio Shack didn't yet exist. You couldn't buy a transformer which had the right voltage winding on the secondary that's appropriate for making a, let's say, 15-volt power supply. You'd like a 15-volt winding. You could buy 6.3-volt windings. You could buy 350-volt windings with Zenitap. You couldn't buy 18 volts. I had to wind my own. And what I did to make it simple is started out with a audio output transformer, put the 110 volts into the primary winding, and wound my own secondary winding that made the right voltage to make the power supply work. That particular piece of equipment is still in use today. Not in use. It's in operation today. That original solid-state transmitter I built way back in the dark ages. Let's see what Rich has got to say about all this. M2EO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Come back to me, Dick. I want to ask another question.
You're on, Joe. I mean, no. Rich first.
Hey, Dick, M2EO. Well, I wanted to make an offer to Joe, and I got a piece of traffic with Glenn. I have a dual-trace Tektronix scope. I don't know where Joe lives, but I do have a test bench downstairs in the basement with the ham shack. If Joe wants to get together over here this week, I don't know how far out on Long Island he is. I'm in Whitestone, Queens, about a mile south of the Slotsnake Bridge. He can email me at n2echooscar@awrl.net, and he's welcome to bring it over, and I'll we'll take a look. I have a two-trace Tektronix scope, and we can see what the story is. And Glenn, I have a piece of traffic for you. I sent you that that information on the frequency standard. I gave you the frequency that the reference oscillator was putting out. I got a service message back today that the email was bounced. So I'll get together with you during the week on the repeater and give you that information again, Glenn. Back to that, and to we go.
Can I respond to Rich?
If you will, in a minute. Your offer of use of your oscilloscope, your dual trace oscilloscope, is an attractive one. Joe lives in Oakdale. It's a reasonably long track between him and Whitestone. And I got an idea of what Joe's involved in right now. He's got another higher priority project. And can he break away right now and do this particular measurement of a project that's already been solved? And now it's the scientist in him that wants to know what went wrong. I guarantee it's not on the highest thing on his priority list right now. But Glenn, go right ahead with your information. KT2QIQ, you got it.
Just to respond to you, Rich, I did receive the email. I got the information about the rubidium standard. I did a whole bunch of calculations. I figured out how it works. Now, the only problem is I would kind of hope that maybe Dick could, because I was going to try to answer you in a simple email, and I figured whatever I was going to email back was just going to make you more confused, and you're going to probably need to ask questions back and feedback. And if Dick is willing, maybe we can open up a little discussion about the rubidium standard a little bit further down the net, if that is allowed there. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, that's another beautiful subject, the rubidium standard. We're going to come back to that. I want to close out for tonight now with the power supply, the mysterious choke in the power supply. We haven't quite gotten to the bottom of this one. We now know a lot of things that we previously suspected. I suspected that his input filter capacitor wasn't big enough in microfarads, but because he's already replaced that, that doesn't confirm. I expected the choke to be leaking. It isn't. If it was leaking, it wouldn't have responded so well with a clip lead across it. He replaced it, and the new one, the old one, we haven't found the difference yet. So there's still a little bit more of a mystery here. The good news is his power supply is back on the air. The bad news is we don't know what in the world went wrong with that choke. Back to you for any final comments, Joe, before we go over to the rubidium discussion. And I've got some comments for Rich on that one. So KQRYY for any final comments. Your choice. KQRYW.net. You got it, Joe.
It's got me, Dick.
Well, the power supply is mounted to my repeater. My repeater's back on the air. It's working. I'm not going to take the power supply out to be a scientist with it. I can't do that. I don't have a working backup supply right now to even take apart and put the choke in place of a working supply to do anything with it. I don't know. I don't know what else I can do with this thing to test it. So, Dick, as far as you're thinking, with the low current I'm drawing, which is approximately 3 milliamps of current with 18 volts, or so in the series circuit I had. You think the current is so low that it's giving me a false inductive reading? Is that what you're believing right now? And would using a higher AC voltage possibly yield a different reading with the same kind of reactive choke? Because I can do that. I do have the availability of this other supply. Can give me about 270 volts AC. I could apply across this choke with a series dropping resistor and do the same thing at 60 hertz with a much, much higher voltage and press across the choke, possibly enough to draw a little more current and close to its design. Now, let me tell you about the power supply itself. It's not Motorola. It's actually GE power supply. It's on some fairly old equipment. The tube draws approximately 220 to 250 mils of current with a DC voltage of about 700 volts or so. It's very happy with that kind of rating. So the choke normally is putting out maybe a maximum of 250 mils of current through this choke with a potential of about 700 volts DC running the transmitter. So that's its normal type of circuit application.
Okay, very glad to know that, Joe. I went back over all of your previous emails, and nowhere was I able to find out rare information about the resistor R260, which I think is 10 ohms, which is a sensing resistor somewhere in the output of the supply. I didn't know the voltage drop across it, and I couldn't figure out what the current was. I guess that it's in the vicinity of a quarter of an ampere, 250 mils or so. Now, when a choke has 250 mils of DC current flowing through it, its inductance will come down. When the AC voltage going through a choke increases, its inductance will come down. And by the way, the DC voltage would lower the inductance much faster than AC. And yes, every choke has a magnetic core that'll saturate somewhere. So if you put 60 cycle or 120 cycle voltage across the choke, and you make that voltage bigger and bigger, eventually the BH curve will show a right-hand saturation, a left-hand saturation. Everything will saturate somewhere, with the exception of air. And so you've got to be careful how you rate that. But I am guessing right now that choke right now is not acting bad. However, you haven't put a quarter of an ampere through it, a DC current, simultaneous with the AC. That's a difficult thing to do. And plugging it into a working power supply is one approach. I think you took that choke out of another power supply, and maybe that power supply can be put back up in operation for this further science experiment when you've got the time. And I know you're involved in another project right now which is taking up your time. Let's see, before we go over to the rubidium experiment, Mel, I kept forgetting to go back to him. K2KEY, straighten this all out on this one, Mel. K2RIW.
This is K2KEY. What I was saying earlier about the power transformer, I think you misunderstood me. The power transformer, the filaments didn't go out completely. They went down. They went down if you measured the filaments. Across the filament, you got to maybe about 3.5, 4 volts of AC across the filament. If you took the filament winding, off the filament winding went back up to 6.3. Now, what's happening in the transformer? The 5-volt winding that's also on that transformer for the rectifier stayed normal. The B-plus windings were normal. What was happening, what was all these tubes doing to this transformer that after a number of years of use, that it will no longer produce the 6.3 volts of filament under load, under all the tube load. In other words, if I took all those tubes and just took that winding loose and stuck a pilot light across it, it would light normally at 6.3, That's my question. What's taking place inside that power transformer that's making the filament voltage not go out, but go down quite a bit? And yet, when you disconnect one end of it, it goes back to normal, over.
Yeah, my best guess on that one, Bill, is increased series resistance. A 6.3-volt filament winding of an old-fashioned 60-cycle power transformer that used to be in almost every single television set in the old days, that winding had something like a tenth of an ohm of series resistance. My goodness. Just heard fire trucks go by outside in front of my house. All's well. It had something like that. If you put a good ohmmeter across that 6.3-volt winding, I think you would measure something like a tenth of an ohm. When the 6.3-volt winding failed, you know the way a transformer is wound inside. It's got a bunch of varnish-colored wire, covered wire, and every so often the wire breaks out of the transformer and is twisted with a green and yellow wire that twisted together, hopefully soldered, some kind of insulating material put over top of them, and they're packed back into the transformer and the shell is closed down. And if one of those connections somewhere developed 10 ohms of resistance instead of a tenth of an ohm of resistance, when you try to draw 10 amperes out of there, you're going to get a 10-volt drop, and you're going to get 6.3 to work with. So with your AC voltmeter, which has got a 10 megohm input impedance, and you measure the voltage on the transformer, which has got 10 ohms of series resistance, you're going to measure 6.3. Put it under the real load of the real tubes, and the 10 ohm resistance that is continuously there in that winding after the failure now gives you a voltage drop that drops your 6.3 down to 3 volts or whatever. So excess series resistance is my best guess as to what went on. And had you done a very careful measurement, and by the way, it's not easy to measure tenth of an ohm with a volt ohm milliammeter. The only way to really accurately measure something like that is a so-called 4-leaded ohmmeter test. It's called a Kelvin connection. Two of the wires apply the current, and the other two wires measure the voltage drop, and you do a calculation as to what is the resistance, as opposed to with a real triplet or Simpson meter, you try to measure a tenth of an ohm, and if you get within 4/10 of an ohm of a reading, you're in the right ballpark. So had you measured the ohms of that winding, I think you might have seen the difference. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Hey, I went that first step. I have taken some of the transformers that I replaced. I take the transformer, you know, those days you can take the four screws out and pull the covers off the transformer. And that's what I thought, that those two leads coming out, the green lead and the green stripe lead, one of them most likely where it goes to the winding, maybe the solder connection was, you know, cooked out, that the solder started to, you know, come apart and you got a faulty connection there. Absolutely not. I restarted it. And everything, same problem. There's something in the internal winding. Now, that's most likely for a 6.3 winding. It must have been a continuous winding in there. I don't think it had any more taps or anything or any kind of other places where it's spliced. So something else, and the only thing I can account for, something in the heating is getting hot. Those transformers used to get very, very hot, as you know. That you couldn't put your hand near it. I mean, you would burn your hand, of course, you put it on the transformer and that power transformer. Something happened when it would cook out. I think because of that, it cooked something in the copper of the wiring. Maybe it altered the copper wiring in some way, Dick, and created this situation. They used to call it now a soft winding. That's how they used to refer to it, over.
Yeah, as that transformer gets hot and it expands, it's putting a mechanical stress on that 6.3-volt winding, all of those turns. You confirm that where the varnish-colored wire, covered wire, came out and was twisted to the green and yellow lead and soldered, you confirm that that was good. But if one of those, let me pick a number, 150 turns inside, developed a stress fracture because of mechanically being stressed by the expansion of the core when the core gets hot, and that wire partially broke so that now the wire is necked down in some area, not completely disconnected, you'd have no voltage at all, but again the winding developed an extra resistance when it's under temperature. So under temperature, in other words, you have the transformer hot, see the fact that you're only getting 3 volts to the tubes instead of 6.3, at that instant of time, turn everything off and measure ohms from green lead to green and yellow lead. I didn't say it's easy, but had you measured those ohms, I think you would have measured not a tenth of an ohm, but you would have measured 1 or 2 ohms, which is all it takes to drop the 6.3 down to 3 volts when you're drawing all of those amperes of all of those filaments in parallel. It's a weird failure. I've had some weird failures like that that have driven me up a wall. And I know that when you cleaned out your basement in the place where you're storing all the electronics, that's where that bad transformer was. It went into the garbage. Therefore, you don't have a chance to go back and measure it, is my guess. But it would have been a lot of fun to now go back after all these years and find out what happened with that winding. I am guessing that one of those turns partially broke, not quite all the way through, but developed extra ohms, is my best guess. Mel, go ahead.
So if you had this transformer by itself sitting on the workbench, and you said, oh, well, I'm going to build a project, let me just see if this transformer is good, you would go ahead, you'd put 110 volts on it, you'd check the 3-4 windings on it, and what would you say the transformer would be, would pass the bench test? This is what I'm saying. See, on the actual condition, this is what I'm trying to allude to. With his actual condition, something else takes place. Bench testing, it is all fine and good, but it's not the same thing as an actual operation. So, because if you took that transformer, like I just said, and tested it and on the bench before you built the project with it, would you say that transformer would pass your test? Over.
There's a yes and a no to that one, Mel. There are bench tests and there are bench tests. You can buy a traveling wave tube dummy load. By that I mean, there's a zillion ways that the 10,000 volts and all the other regulated voltages that feed a traveling wave tube have to be done just right. That power supply has got to do a lot of things just right. You can buy a bench testing circuit that is not a traveling wave tube, but it's got just the right dummy loads and just the right places to put the power supply under working conditions. That power supply will think he is feeding a tube. In reality, he's feeding this great big test network that's got a bunch of resistors and capacitors and so on. So, in theory, I didn't say it's easy. But in theory, you and I could have put dummy load resistors on the 5-volt winding, the 6-volt winding, so that that winding is subjected to normal current that it would see in a real television set. And I could put dummy load resistors on the secondary winding, the 350-volt center tap, and so on. So, in theory, I could make a very elaborate bench test. But the quickie bench test that we all do is to put 110 volts in there and see if I got the right voltages. That's a necessary but not sufficient. The next step, if you wanted to be super thorough, and it's not easy, is to put real load resistors everywhere. Back to you, Mel. KQRIW.
I can see a point, but normally, at that, you know, you say, gee, maybe it's a transformer, and you went ahead and you put some load on it, unless you put 24 tubes or something on it, most likely you wouldn't have seen the effect. So I would say that you most likely and I would have passed that, and maybe that transformer would work in our project if we were only going to light up maybe 3-4 tubes, Dick, or whatever, 5 tubes. Most likely it would work, that transformer. Only when it got to the point, maybe if I would take the tubes out of the set, start taking it out and get down to 5 tubes and set, the filament would come up. So, you see, that's it. And I can say it's not a simple thing. It's not, I don't think you and I ever did that kind of extensive testing of a power transformer before we built something. That's my final word on it. Over.
Oh, I've got to agree with you on that one. We don't go that deep. Then we just continue building the circuit and then test it, the fact that everything works afterwards. Give it a smoke test, as I used to say. And if it fails the smoke test, then you start digging deeper. My next step in that transformer, to build all of those dummy loads, would be a little bit too elaborate. If I had just the right kind of a really good ohm meter test, I'd like to try to confirm that that winding only has 1/10 of an ohm. But even there, I got to be careful, because the winding experiences extra heating when it's under real load for, let's say, 10 minutes. There is a slim possibility that the winding would pass the ohmmeter test until you really heated up the core and really put it under full load for 10 solid minutes. So intermittents are, of course, the toughest kind of troubleshooting. I had an IF can in a 4.5 megacycle audio system of a television set where the IF can would intermittently develop a shorted turn on either its primary or secondary winding, and the audio would go out, but only after the set heated up. And, of course, that drove me up a wall. It took me a long time to find that one, because how often do you, on television service of 1960, say, replace IF cans in the IF strip of a television set? That's something that 99% of the time is super reliable, and you don't worry about that. You're looking for failing capacitors and failing resistors and failing tubes and failing transformers and fuses and things like that and wiring. The IF can, when they fail, is rare, but when they do, it'll really keep you busy for an awful long period of time. Okay, the next subject I think we should discuss is Rich's rubidium power supply. From eBay, he bought, I believe, a respected brand, rubidium frequency standard power supply, and when he feeds it the right serial word, it'll produce anything from a very low frequency up to 20 megacycles, and you've got ridiculous resolution in that word. Let me drop. Depending on what serial word you load into the memory of his rubidium power supply, you could set it for making 20 megs or 10 megs or 5 megs of standard frequency. You could even ask it for 10.001 megahertz with 13 decimal places of accuracy. If you give it the right serial word, his power supply will do that. Well, it wants a hexadecimal, or is it a, I think it wants a hexadecimal word. And the problem is that it wants a word that's got a fraction to it. See, ordinarily, when you take your handheld calculator and you convert from binary to convert from decimal to binary to octal to hexadecimal, when you do those conversions, the calculator is wired in such a way that it assumes you're starting off with a number that is an integer. And here's the problem. The number that Rich wants to program is 8765.4321, so to speak. It's a fractional number, a non-integer number. And normal conversion procedures for decimal into hexadecimal does not tolerate a non-integer number. So now, built into the programming of that network is further information. Maybe to the left of the decimal point is considered a integer, and to the right of the decimal point is considered another integer. And now, by some kind of fancy programming, you combine those two integers into two separate hexadecimal or binary coded decimal or whatever words. But the fact that it's asking for a fractional number gives my calculator a lot of grief. Now, maybe Glenn's got an answer to that. I'm going to pass it to Glenn first, because he's already started studying this problem. KC2QIQ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yes, actually, I got an email from Rich, and it basically explains a frequency electronics rubidium standard called an FE5680A. And apparently this article represents some modifications that were made to this rubidium standard so that they could get a 50.0255 megahertz output, and which it normally doesn't do. It's a modification that has to be made to it. And then, of course, there's also a digital interface with some external software that operates in an RS-232 port. And my first question for Rich is, does he have all of those modifications done, as in this article, and do you have the software and a computer with the RS-232 port all available to you so that you can plug these numbers in? N2EO, KC2QIQ.
Sorry, Glenn. I sent you back a second email. I made the mod that is described in the article. That's 50.2 whatever You have to give it a command. I believe it's the letter S. I'm upstairs right now. I'm going to go downstairs. I think it's the letter S as in Sam. And it spits back the actual reference number for the particular unit. And I have that number downstairs. I believe I sent it to you. And then based on that number, you use that number to correlate the proper divide by N number to come out with the frequency that you want. Yes, I made them odds. I'm getting RF out of it. I can read the RF on a counter. The RF 232 port is in. And yes, I can address the port.
Okay, very good. Now, my next thing is to, I'm going to shoot towards you, Dick. The equation to get the output frequency of this is given by FO, which is the output frequency that's desired, and is equal to N divided by 2 to the 32nd power times the reference frequency. And the reference frequency is the number that Rich said he was going to come back with in a minute, and I think I have it here in another email. Do you got that so far, Dick? Can you write this down? Because we have to do a couple of calculations here.
Just happen to have it down. So F0 equals November divided by 2 to the 32 power times reference frequency. And the times reference frequency, I presume, is multiplied by the 2 to the 32 power, not by the N. You didn't tell me where you open and close the parentheses, if you know what I mean. Back to you, Glenn.
Sorry about that, Dick. It's N divided by, open the parentheses, 2 to the 32nd power times the frequency, close the parentheses.
Okay. Now, in the case of cesium, the reference frequency that cesium runs at is something like 9.1 gigahertz. In the case of rubidium, it's something like 8 and a fraction gigahertz. I wonder, are they counting down from that, or has the countdown already come down to some other internal reference that you use in that particular calculation? Now, back to you, Glenn.
Okay, here it comes. This is the exact frequency. It's much less than that. It's much lower frequency. So this is in hertz. If you can write this down, 50255055.479270. Do you have that so far, Dick?
What I got out of that is 50255055 decimal. 479270. QSL?
Okay, that's right on the money. And basically, right now, it's around 50 megahertz, just a little bit above that. Now, here's the interesting thing. You can use that equation. You're going to come up with a number for N. Now, N is going to be what has to be converted from a decimal number over to the hexadecimal number. And then if he plugs that number in, basically, he'll get the operating frequency that he's looking for. QSL?
Roger, Dodger. Now, I think the machine that you do the calculation on is going to have to be used in the extended precision mode because the hertz you gave me is 14 decimal places. Very few calculators or computers that are not in the extended precision mode will properly handle a 14-digit number. Go ahead.
Roger, Dodger. That's why I had to open up MathCAD. And now you can get the... Now, the problem is when you go back to hexadecimal, it's a pain in the neck doing that in MathCAD, where it's a lot easier to do that on a... basically, with a Windows XP computer. If you open up calculator, put it into scientific mode, it will actually give you that number of digits.
Yeah, I think some of my Hewlett-Packard computers do have a mode where you can go to... I think it's 24 decimal places in the integer mode. So you have to take this fractional number, force it into an integer, do the calculation, and then reconvert it back, if you know what I mean, in order to get around the problem. Yeah, I think the machines will only handle these great big extended precision numbers when they're in the integer mode. I don't think they will handle those in the fractional mode. And what I think the machine is really doing internally is something equivalent to binary coded decimal. Back to you, Glenn.
Okay, now what I'd like to do is I'd like to ask Rich the exact question of what frequency is he looking for, and maybe between you and I, Dick, we can give Rick the Rich the answer that he needs to get the correct output frequency. QSL?
Roger, Dodger. I bet you he's looking for something like 10 megacycles. You got it there, Rich.
Okay, Dick, I just got down here. It takes a while for me to get down the stairs. Rich. I have that number, Dick.
Yeah, you're looking for something like 10 megacycles of output frequency. That's the reference frequency you desire. Is that true, Rich?
That is correct, Dick. 10 megacycles even. And the number I have here is 50255055. Let's see, where's the decimal point here? I think it's 50.255055479270. Is that what you have?
That's the number that you sent me with the email. That's the number that Glenn has. That's the number that I've got. So we're all on the same page. And he wants 10 megacycles. Okay. 2 to the 32 power. Yeah. 2 to the 32 power times that number is going to wipe out that decimal place. It's going to move it way over to the right. We're going to have 14 decimal places and then some of an integer. That's the way I think I see it going. Glenn, go ahead.
Yes, but what's interesting is with the modification, he gives a code over here. He says, for an output frequency of 10.000000 megahertz with a level of 6.6 dBm, the result was a frequency that he plugged in for N of 32F0AB000000. That's the hexadecimal number.
Okay, it would sound like that is the answer as to what he's going to program into his serial generator. What do you think?
I think that's it. It's just that now the question goes back to Rich. Rich, have you tried that number that's in that document and tried plugging that in to see if that actually works for you?
Okay, I tried a number of different numbers. I don't think I tried that one, but his reference, he says here the value of he received a reference value which was different. That number, which is 52.50255056353937. That's the number he got back when he hit his with the S.
I see that between that that difference in there, but I'm wondering, have you ever tried plugging in the 32F0AB number?
No, I don't remember. It's been a few days. I just don't remember. I don't want to say yeah and then I'm wrong. No.
What I'm going to do, Rich, is I'm going to do another calculation. Now that we've kind of explained this a little bit on the air, what actually is going on here, I'm going to do another calculation between MathCAD and use my calculator while I'm sitting here in the background. You can discuss this with Dick, because I would suggest you try that number first, because that's what he's saying he used to get that 10 megahertz output. Now, it's in that email. Do you know the area that I'm I guess you did, because you already mentioned what his reference frequency was, to try to plug that number in. And in the meantime, what I'm going to do is go back to the equation and see if I just use that equation, what number I come up with.
We have a bit of a logistical problem. That is that I have to plug this thing back in. I have a connector that I have to finish wiring up, because I didn't have any RS-232 connectors. They since came in, and I had it just patched up with wires soldered together. I was actually going to do that tomorrow, so I can't actually get in there and do it right now.
Okay, Rich, I think what we could do here is at least you have a starting number to try when you do get it put together. And in the meantime, sometime during the week, because it looks like I've got a little bit of time to do this, I'll do the other calculation for the other number for you and give you the hexadecimal number and the digital number together. And then you can try that one as well and see if you have results and come back to us on the TechNet next week. And hopefully we can put this one to bed. Over to you, Dick. K2RAW, KC2QIQ.
And when he does put it to bed, he'll have the most frequency, most accurate frequency reference in all of Whitestone, maybe all of Queens County, for all we know. Let's see, are there any broadcast stations in Queens County? There probably are. And some broadcast stations are using them, rubidium and cesium standards. Okay, so frequency standards are fun things. I'm looking at my list now, and I think there were no further people signing in with a yes today. I hope Paul is available, because I think very soon there's going to be a launch for the repair of Hubble, and that's going to be exciting stuff. This is the very last, the end, c'est fini. This is all there is that Hubble's ever going to get from all we know right now. This one's got to be good, because zillions and zillions of high school kids and grade school kids wrote into NASA saying that please don't abandon the Hubble. I'm a Hubble hugger, and arguably it's the most prolific or the most high-performance piece of equipment that NASA ever created, and there are lots of people out there saying you can't abandon that. It told us more in an exciting way than anything else we want to know. So very, very soon, I think, a launch is going to take place. Let's see if Paul's available. WS2N, if you're there. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hey, QEJ, with a couple of questions. And Hubble launches in the morning.
Okay, so it's coming.
Take WS2N. Let me see if I have it.
Yeah, let's see what Eric, let me go to Eric first, Paul, and then we're going to go to you. K2EJ, go right ahead.
All right, I got a couple questions for you. The shuttle launches in the morning. That's a statement. That's not a question. I want to know what you think about the RF quality of the repeater, because I think I did something about that today. I want to know, did you finally get to read the QEX article, and what's your opinion on that? And sorry, Rich, I have a more accurate frequency standard in my house than Queens. And I have another thing, but we'll do that another time. Oh, and tonight I'll be moving channel 22 to channel 21 to test out the system and the mass filter and all that stuff. K2RIWK, Junior.
So sometime in the middle of the night, a digital transmission from channel 21 will take place, is what I think you're saying. Yes, I did see the article in QEX, and he didn't emphasize very much the way he set up the antenna range itself as far as the physical layout of the source antenna and the antenna on the test. Was my first fast reading. He's got some real good hardware with reference to azimuth and elevation positioning of the antenna on the test and methods of recording that. But half of the art and science of a good reflective ground plane antenna range or a backyard antenna range is the way you set up the source. And I didn't see him emphasizing that portion very much. He made it sound like you just put the source out there, you put the antenna and the test out there, and as long as you're positioning it accurately and got a good shaft encoder, everything's going to be good after that. Well, there's a lot more to it than that. I'm not sure that the article included enough of that. Maybe his whole philosophy was there were previous articles on that subject, and he didn't have to repeat it. Okay, so tomorrow morning is the launch. I'm going to ask you... I'm going to turn it back to you, Rich. There we go. Eric, what time? And roughly what time tonight will you be over to digital so that Joe can be watching the quality of the digital? K2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Also take a look at your signal strength meter and tell me that the repeater is back up where you're just saying it. I don't remember what the launch time is. I think it's something like 10 o'clock in the morning, but I could be wrong. I'm sure somebody else knows the exact time. And I'm actually heading to the station now, so I can't just look it up. What time? Let's see. I'm going to take the analog off here. I've got a T
disconnect your 6-inch coax, and I have a an impedance matching hunk of pipe that goes from 6-inch to 3-inch, which will take me from 75 ohms, which is the feed to the antenna, to 50 ohms, which will be what's coming out of the transmitter. And I suspect I'll probably get on the air probably around 3 o'clock, 2:30, 3 o'clock this morning. Then I'll run it for maybe an hour or so, make sure the transmitter's happy and the mass filter works nice, and look at the reflected energy coming back. We're going to sweep the whole darn thing first. Unfortunately, I wish I had a VNA, but I don't, and I'm going to probably have to wait for the manufacturing folks to come with one and do that measurement for me, but I'm going to use a tracking counter and a spectrum analyzer to give me an idea of the shape of the filter and make sure it looks kind of flat. K2RIW, KU2J.
Sounds like you're going to make a scalar measurement instead of a vector measurement. Directional coupler, tracking generator, and spectrum analyzer on the directional coupler. That's what it sounds like. And that's a good measurement. I can tell the repeater on 8.5 is putting out quite a bit more power than it has previously. I think you were at the site making modifications today, so I do would like to know what power was it periodically jumping down to, and are you 5 dB above normal power right now, or so to speak, Eric? Back to you, Eric.
No, there was a problem with a hunk of cable, a 6-inch hunk of cable, and basically it wasn't making the connection. It was capacitively coupling the R up to the antenna. So we were probably getting about a watt into the antenna. Now we're getting out of the duplex. Well, the amplifier is making about 80 watts. When you finally get out of the duplex, you get about 40 watts. Today I was out at Sheldon doing the same thing, you know, bringing that up to snuff. And I put a battery backup system on both controllers so that they don't get stupid and forget what time of day it is. By the way, it's only on the transmit side, feeding the duplexes, not on the antenna itself. So the receiver's always been excellent. K2RIW, K2J.
2EO, Dick. That's good to know. Thank you. What's your comment, Rich?
Yeah, I just wanted to let Eric know the 1288 megahertz repeater, which was working okay yesterday, was crackling. In fact, it's crackling right now. I have it on. There's a crackling sound on the repeater. Not to be the bearer of bad news, but that's the story on 1288. It's got good output here at Whitestone. I worked Barry and 2MB on it. I worked a few other people, but it's crackling. Back to that.
Thanks, Rich.
Okay, so I'm going to go over to Paul now. Paul, give us some words on that launch tomorrow. That launch was supposed to take place last fall, and I think 1 week before the launch, a major communication system on Hubble failed. They suddenly realized that much more repair is required, and this repair is a assembly that was never intended to be repaired in space. I think it's the one with 100 screws. And so what do we know about tomorrow's launch? And I presume there's like a window tomorrow, a window on Tuesday, and so on. WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. As of a couple of days ago when I looked at it, it was 2:01 tomorrow is the launch schedule for the 11-day mission. 5 spacewalks to complete this mission. That's quite a bit. And they're going about 100 miles higher than they normally would for the International Space Station. They've done this, 5 times before, or 4 times, I think. This is the fifth surface mission up to the Hubble. So it should be interesting to watch the 100 screw yet. That's just to get into the area. Then I got to pull the boards, the circuit boards, none of which was meant for servicing. Otherwise, they wouldn't have a screw configuration. They'd probably have a lot of dog types of connections where you would just take your big heavy gloves and move a lot of dog type lever things out of the way, and you be able to pull it off if it was serviceable. And then they got to pull the little boards out that failed in the computers. And, to do that, you know, they got to be careful. That was not meant to be taken out, so that has some sharp edges and things involved. They can't penetrate the gloves, otherwise they'll be caught in the vacuum. Let me drop it there. You've got a pilot that's in charge of this, 49 years old, is the commander, and you've got 5 people on board for mission specialists, which we'll be doing, out of that group, we'll be doing the 5 spacewalks. So, they're going to save the Hubble, launched, 1990, with all those bad problems in the beginning, with the mirror that was not ground properly, so the thickness of a hair or something different, and it gave them very blurry pictures. But with the correction, with the Story Musgrave group that did the spacewalk years ago, turned out to be the best instrument that they've ever put up, and a lot of people are Hubble huggers after almost 20 years of operation from 1990. So we'll look forward to it. Going to change a lot of equipment out, gyros, batteries, you name it. And they do have a standby crew. At one time this thing was canceled. Let me drop it. After the Columbia disaster, they thought maybe it wouldn't be best to go save the Hubble anymore. You go up there, you can't go to the space station. You can't, deorbit and go to a different plane or even a different altitude very easily without burning up a lot of fuel. I think you can only change, 3 degrees of inclination. That's using all your fuel. That's about it. And you're going from one big plane of, International Space Station, I think, is, 56 degrees or something. And where the Hubble is, 59 or something degrees. Whatever, you can't go from one to the other. So they have to, now, according to the flight rules for this mission, they have Endeavour standing by at 39B. In case they have a problem up there, go up and bring them back. And there are only, 2 astronauts up, and bring back the other 7 that went up to service the mission. They're going to change out the wide field camera 3, guidance sensors. I don't know. I haven't read the PDF file. I usually do. I'm sure it's packed, filled with information. The press kit, they call it the press kit. Packed full, filled with information. I'll probably do that during the mission. And what's involved during each and every one of these EVAs. Back to you, Dick. WS Storm.
When you said it's going off at 2 tomorrow, is that 2 a.m. local time, 2 p.m. local time? What time is that blast off is question number 1. And question number 2, I believe on each of the previous repair missions, after the repair is done, the Hubble connected to the space station gets boosted to a slightly higher orbit because it is always slowly decaying. I wonder if that operation is going to take place. Back to you, Paul.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure they will. I mean, it doesn't deorbit as badly as the International Space Station. By the way, I don't know if it's... if it's 2 in the morning or not, I'll have to check the internet. I remember a lot of the Hubble flights, they always went up our time. It was always dark. It was always night flight. Came back at night as well. So I wouldn't be surprised if it's 2 a.m. I'll have to check the internet. Go to NASA.gov, and they'll give you an update. That's where you get the press kit, too. They have the short version and the long version on every one of these missions. So, Hubble will definitely be boosted up to a higher altitude. Because it's at 300 miles roughly, and the space station is roughly 200 miles, the space station not only is bigger, that helps degrade the orbit, it's also lower.